Yo, 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 and welcome back to Creeps and Crimes
Podcast.
I'm Taylor.
I'm Morgan. Happy Thursday and happy episode
186.
Good girl.
This is the week of the wedding.
I was testing you. It is the week of the wedding.
Your
wedding is in 2 days.
2 days from the time that you guys are listening to this. But really, the festivities start on Friday.
The festivities really start actually today.
Tomorrow.
I'll be getting my spray.
Yep. This is where the deets start going in.
Yeah.
Hardcore.
So you won't go get your nails done with me, right? You're doing press?
When are you gonna get them done?
Maybe like Tuesday.
Text me.
Okay.
I might go. We'll see.
Okay.
I was actually thinking about it today because my nails are in such horrific shape because I cannot stop picking at them.
Yeah.
But I just can't connect.
Should I just do like your basic French? I should.
Yeah, do a basic.
When did I tell you I wanted to do red? Remember I said that? You're like, you're not doing that.
Absolutely not. You're gonna do a French. This is just classic.
Silly girl.
I did the like ombre. I wish I would have done French. I'll never forget me sitting there
what
being
shape
like
French though. Oval for me.
I think
I'm always an oval bitch.
I think I did oval. No, I did oval. And then I went home and got a picture of myself. But you have an oval ring. I have a
square ring.
Like square rectangular ring.
Yeah.
It looked fucking crazy.
Did it?
It just looked
well,
crazy.
Actually,
so I went back and got a
not fixed. Tuesday. I would do Wednesday because mm-hmm. then I'm working Wednesday and then I'm off, so then I won't be putting gloves on and off.
Yeah.
Ooh. I don't want to be putting gloves on and off.
What about your
Wednesday.
Spray tan?
Oh fuck.
You know what? Get them done before the spray tan, because if you get them done after, there'll be too much oil and they'll pop off.
True.
So you'll just put, she'll probably give you like a serum to put on them. This girl, she does weddings all the time.
Yeah, so festivities start tonight, spray tan. Tomorrow we have rehearsal dinner, welcome party.
Yep.
Saturday we have wedding.
Wedding.
Whew. I feel like it was just yesterday where I was like, oh, it's in 3 months.
No, I feel like it was just yesterday that we didn't have a date. We didn't know what we were doing, where we were being.
On my trail, you're like, Morgan, are you going to get married or not?
No, literally.
I'm like, I have no.
It was like a goal that we set for ourselves at some point to be like, when we get back from this trip.
No motivation, guys.
Maybe it was Italy where we were like pre-recording. We were like, when we come back from this trip, we will tell you that we have a wedding date. Or there was something that
was
like
was
a break.
Italy.
Maybe it was Christmas. I don't know.
Because we had just went to that one venue before I went to Italy, which was this time last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, no, I love it. But like, I wouldn't give them my check.
Yeah, I remember.
I was like, I'm just not. Sold.
I'm not. You like had a date and everything. They were just waiting for your.
Yeah, I just had to go drop the check off. And then one day at work, guys, I was just like, fuck it. Like, this is not the right venue.
Yep.
Google search again. This venue came up out of fucking nowhere. I swear to you, it was not there the first search. And I was like, emailed them. I was like, do you have an appointment available? I need to come to your facility.
Right now, I need to be there.
And they were like, yeah, come today. And I was
come
like, perfect. Went, wrote the check, booked
Boom.
The date that day.
Boom.
I was like, this is the place.
Yeah, and that's just how it works out.
It was everything
That's
that was
fate.
Missing from the other one. I know.
Yep. We're not going to be able to talk for too long. And there's so many things I want to discuss just because I feel like I've missed you guys only because I've been listening and working so hard for you guys right now that I just have so much shit I want to tell you.
She's on the fucking grind.
I'm on the fucking grind.
She is carrying us to the finish line.
I mean, literally.
May 1st can't come closer soon enough.
I'm telling you guys, I feel like I've got a sled on my back and I'm running. But here we are.
Also, I thanked her for doing something yesterday.
It was this morning.
She literally told me to shut the fuck up. Thank you. She made fun of me like the SpongeBob text.
Yeah.
I was like, literally, I'm going to kill you. Just let me fucking thank you.
She said, thank you so much for doing that. Fuck off. Literally don't say that shit to me. Just shut the fuck up. She said it. See, if it was like a one-off, it was a one-off yesterday.
All I said was thanks for running that. I didn't say so much.
Hold
I
on.
It wasn't,
it's because last night.
No explanation.
Last night, we were on the phone and she was like, hey, thanks so much. I'm like, all right. So I played it nice. But then she said it again today. I'm like, I'm gonna beat your fucking ass. It's really not that big of a deal. Stop doing this. Stop being fucking used to me. It takes you so much.
Last time, so whenever you give me this gift, I'm gonna blow over. You don't wanna thank you.
No.
I'll just be like,
I want you to cry your eyes out. That's enough that I need
keep
to.
Okay, wait. Also, right before you go in there, I keep picturing me and my dad walking down the aisle.
Dude,
and I
that
keep
got
sobbing.
Me. You know what got me too? I don't even know if I want to put this thought in your head. Dude, when like the night before my wedding, I can't fall asleep.
Yeah, I know. I'm not going
to
be able to sleep.
I'm twitch. And my mom told me to take like a Benadryl or something, but I knew I'd be groggy. If we would have had those fucking CBD gummies that we have, bitch, I'd be sleeping so fine and not wake up with like a headache or anything. Anyways, I'm laying in bed. I can't fall asleep. And I'm just replaying like every path I could sob. Every path I could have taken in my life. But like, I was thinking about, oh my God, how like I'll never move back in with my parents.
Oh my God, stop.
You know, like that's, I could literally cry. And I was also
my mom says to me the other day.
What?
April 20th, I get my Easy Pass back. I said, bitch, shut the fuck up. No, you're not taking it back.
Beth Ann?
Don't you dare.
That's your wedding gift. Like, are you fucking,
for life.
You don't want me to come back home?
For life.
What are you talking about right now, Beth Ann? No, literally shit like that. Like that's all I thought about. And I thought about like exes that I, like what would my life had looked like if I would have stayed in that relationship? Dude, that shit fucked me up. Anyways, so I don't remember what I was still listening to the girls' bathroom, but I don't even want to go down that conversation anymore because this is what I want to talk about. Morgan and I have been chit chat every single fucking second of the day for the last 2 days because today is the final day. This is the fucking final countdown of Morgan working on the podcast, and it's what, April 10th?
I don't come back till May.
Yeah, it's Wednesday, April 10th. Morgan does not touch the podcast from today until then. So we've been trying to get like everything that she needs to be a part of done. We've been like obviously like blowing each other up, making plans for what today is.
Actually though, yesterday when we FaceTimed was the first time that we FaceTimed since last Tuesday.
Yeah.
It was a week apart.
For
we've
real.
Phone called
we
and
phone
texted,
called a million
but
times.
That was our first, when I saw it on my computer and it was like, when I went to FaceTime you and it said like the last one, I scrolled down, it was like Tuesday. I was like, oh my God.
It's been a hot second.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've been like grinding that hard. So we get off FaceTime. You know, we know what the plans are for today. I wake up, I do what I'm supposed to do. I'd run that errand for Morgan. She does, thank you. And then I get back home and I'm killing what I'm supposed to do. I'm editing the hell out of the episode that y'all are listening to a week ago. And I get done at noon and I'm like shocked because I really was thinking that I was going to be scraping in. And I'm like, what the hell can I do? So I'm like, I'm going to deep clean the whole house. I just couldn't sit in this fucking room anymore without decluttering the entire thing. I forget that we're recording. Morgan texts me out of nowhere and then she gets here and she's like, I'm on my way or whatever you said. Morgan gets here and tells me the story. We both forgot what
we were
doing.
Yeah, we were both literally just running around our house cleaning. And like at one point I was like, oh my God, I have to record. What am I doing?
What are we doing? So we both get here and we're like out of breath, looking sweaty, looking crazy. And she's like, I just deep cleaned the hell out of my old kitchen. I'm like, I just deep cleaned that. When she came up the stairs, I had a screwdriver and a wrench in my hand. And I had to sit
first
down.
First thing I said, looks good in here.
Yeah. And I'm like, well, and then
don't look back there.
Don't look in the back. That's where everything is.
How's the bathroom looking down there?
Oh, like shit. But I did organize the tools. I just was looking at them when I was on the toilet this morning. I was like, I need to organize that. You ready to get into it?
Yeah.
Hit them with it.
See you guys as a married woman. If you're driving, throw that shit on cruise control.
If you got a glass, pour that shit up and toast it to Morgan and Aaron.
Ooh, and let's get creepy.
Going to the chapel and she's gonna get married. Okay. Morgan, you have nothing for us today. It's me.
It's Tay Tay.
It's all about
me. Thank you
so
much for letting me do this.
Fuck off. Guys, since we, you know, did the creepy and we got off, we made a turkey sandwich, you know, whatever. And Morgan said thank you for her turkey sandwich. And I was like, I'm going to literally throw you down the stairs.
Thank you for this is what I said.
Yeah, thank you for this. Fuck out of here. And then we got an email in that same second of someone saying, thank you thank so much you. For this.
Thanks for this.
Everyone's done. Everyone's done. Stop
so
it.
So much thanks.
So much thanks. Okay. But before I get into this big case that I've made you guys hold on to forever, I've got to tell you guys something that happened to me literally yesterday.
Oh, I can't wait.
I can't get over. I've never been so embarrassed about it because we've all had embarrassing BO moments. I was in Pilates and it was my first Pilates class in a minute, but it was a cardio class. And I went in the afternoon instead of the morning. And because of that, I just kind of like threw myself together in the morning. I took a shower, but I forgot to put deodorant on and I'm on my period. So I'm fragrant these days, you know? So I forgot to put on my deodorant. I'm working out in class and I put my hands up. I get a whiff. I'm like,
immediately, oh, I can no God. Longer do arms.
I need to leave. That's literally how I felt. Thankfully, they had some spray in the bathroom. So I just went and put that on and came back. But it wasn't my favorite because what I've been using recently, I don't know if I've even told you about this. I've been obsessed with Lumi.
Me too.
All of the products that they sent us, I'm obsessed.
Fortunately, Lumi Whole Body Deodorant is making it so none of us ever have to worry about BO again. Unlike certain other deos, Lumi is powered by mandelic acid to control odor in a new way. They deliver outrageous 72-hour odor control everywhere, from your pits to your feet, and yes, even your privates.
In fact, it was a patient's concern about private part odor that originally inspired the OBGYN who invented Lumi. Fast forward 6 years, and her game-changing whole body deo has now earned over 300,000 five-star reviews from people like me who love feeling confident from head to toe.
My favorite Lumi product is the acidified deodorant wipes. Whenever I'm working a long shift and I'm like, oh, I need to refreshen up.
Yep.
Have these in my bag, ready to go, run to the bathroom, wipe myself down, and I come back feeling like I'm fresh out of the shower. Dude, I'm not even kidding you.
I put them in my car and I ran out the other day because from when Lumi sent us some a few months ago, I ran out for the first time. I sprinted to Target to go get some because I was like, I have to have them right
bangs
now.
Bangs card on table.
Bangs card on table so hard.
It's a whole body deodorant created by an OBGYN that blocks odor all day and controls odor for up to 72 hours.
Dang. It's baking soda free, paraben free, and the pH is balanced, queens, for safe use below the belt. And they have so many amazing, fresh, bright scents. They have a lavender sage, which you guys know is one of my favorites, clean tangerine, and toasted coconut, which I haven't tried yet.
And the cool cucumber.
Oh, the cucumber, yes.
Lumi starter pack is perfect for new customers. It comes with a solid stick deodorant, cream tube deodorant, two free products of your choice like mini body wash and deodorant wipes, and free shipping.
As a special offer for our listeners only, our besties, only you guys, new customers get 15% off all Lumi products with our exclusive code. And if you combine the 15% off with the already discounted starter pack, that equals over 40% off their starter pack.
Use code CREEPSANDCRIMES for 15% off your first purchase at LumiDeodorant.com.
That's code CREEPSANDCRIMES at LumiDeodorant.com.
Thanks, Lumi.
So, we're picking up part two of Joyce Chang. And just a forewarning, what I'm going to be covering today is the case of Chandra Levy. And this case is really all over the place due to how big it was and the pauses that had taken place during the investigation, which will make more sense here in a little bit. So just turn on your listening ears to like 100%. And
crank it up.
Go back 15 seconds when you get confused, or if, because I'm telling you right now, like, it is a bit confusing, but just hold on for dear life. I really tried my best to loop this all in.
Okay.
So on May 6, 2001, Bob and Susan Levy called the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C. from their home in Modesto, California, to report their 24-year-old daughter, Chandra Levy, missing, explaining to police that they had not heard from their daughter in 5 days, which was very much unlike her, but especially because she was supposed to be moving out of her apartment in D.C. and moving back home to Modesto, California, on May 5th or 6th. And they're calling this in on May 6th.
Okay.
The Metropolitan Police did take some action, such as calling around to like other police departments, checking in with local hospitals, and just like seeing if anyone had her, and even going by her apartment, which was located in DuPont Circle, which is where Joyce Chang's apartment was and she went missing from. However, they didn't see any sign of forced entry or a disturbance from the outside, so there was no cause for them to need to enter. And this is really where they stopped, basically telling Bob and Susan that she's an adult, and from what they could tell, everything was fine, but there's really nothing more that they could do, which was obviously not good enough for them. So Bob and Susan began their own investigation, starting with pulling their daughter's phone records as she was still on their plan. Well, by the very next day, May 7th, they had gotten her records back and found a number that she had called several times in the last few months, like from the time that she lived in DC. I'm talking like a daily call for all this time, multiple times sometimes. It was not one that they recognized, so Bob decided to call it. Like, just type it in his phone, give it a call. And who answered changed the entirety of Chandra's case. Bob wasted no time immediately calling DC Metropolitan Police back and reporting that his daughter was having an affair with a married U.S. congressman that was 28 years her senior. That's who answered the phone.
Oh, shit.
To make this all make more sense, I'm going to just full stop really quick and switch directions to give you some background on Chandra and how we got here. So Chandra Ann Levy was born on April 14th, 1977 in Cleveland, Ohio to Robert Bob, is what he goes by, and Susan Levy. And they later welcomed a second child, Chandra's little brother, Adam, into the family. Either in late middle school or just before high school, the Levy family picked up and moved from Ohio to Modesto, California, which sounds familiar because of the Lacey Peterson case, the Yosemite murders, many, many cases I've covered before. But just to refresh, it sits about an hour and a half to the east of San Francisco. And in Modesto, Chandra graduated from Grace M. Davis High School, after which she attended San Francisco State University, where she graduated with a degree in journalism. Chandra decided to continue her education at the University of Southern California in LA to get her master's degree in public administration. And at the time of her disappearance, she was just weeks away from graduating, like walking. Chandra was said to be a phenomenal student with lots of internal drive to work hard and achieve her own goals. She was an honor student who went above and beyond to make connections for herself, even working for the state of California in the governor's office and even in the for the mayor of LA. Now, the reason she was in Washington, D.C. was for a paid internship with the Federal Bureau of Prisons that ran from October 2000 until the end of April 2001. Which is why she was scheduled to move out of her DuPont Circle apartment in D.C. on May 5th or 6th in order to move back to California in enough time to walk in her graduation ceremony. But according to her parents in an interview, as reported by ABC News, she technically had already graduated by completing all the requirements that she needed to graduate in December of 2000. So this was like the reason she didn't walk in that December graduation. She'll walk in the May so she could finish this internship. Either way, while with the Federal Bureau of Prisons, Chandra worked at the headquarters with her supervisor, who was the bureau spokesperson named Dan Dunn or Dune. And Dan reported that he was very impressed with Chandra's work, but especially of her handling of media inquiries regarding the upcoming execution of Timothy McVeigh, who was the Oklahoma City bomber. And according to her co-workers, family, and friends, Chandra's next goal was to actually work for the FBI. Now, that is really all that we know about Chandra's professional and academic careers, but let's talk about her personal life. Chandra's parents, in that same ABC News article that I referenced earlier, said that she was a typical big sister. She was bossy, she was fun, she was playful, she was imaginative, and always had been like very individualistic. And that's a quote from them.
Marley, and that's you.
Yeah, yep, exactly. It's the older sister thing, man. She never liked being told what to do or to be forced in a box. Chandra's personality was larger than life, with a drive that could take her anywhere she wanted to go. She was mature for her age and had the ability to think big. So what I mean by that is she was just wise beyond her years. Meaning when it came to dating, the guys her age just really could never meet her standards fully. So she would date men that were many years older than her. And this was something that her parents knew about her and everyone knew about her. I don't know if I say this in the notes, but not to like make, I don't think it's a big thing, whatever, but I mean, it kind of is because she had an affair with a married man prior to this. Like, I think either a professor or someone that she met in college. Yeah. And it didn't turn out.
An adult figure.
Yeah, it didn't. It was, it's not a good situation, but I don't want you guys to think I'm like talking down about her because I'm not. She's the young person in this situation. So anyway, people knew this about her. Well, just a few weeks before Chandra disappeared, Bob and Susan had actually gone to visit their daughter in DC. They flew from Modesto out there and they found that Chandra was content and seemed very happy. And one of the things that they learned or had confirmation on at least while visiting was that Chandra had this like secret friend. She would call them like my guy, my secret friend, who she would go out with after hours. They had no idea who he was, but they assumed that he was an older, possibly married man. Mm-hmm. And based on what they were told either by her or what was inferred by her was that he was relatively powerful, which is why everything was so secretive about their relationship. Because of this, Chandra's routine was relatively the same each day, according to former FBI agent Brad Garrett, who worked her case. Chandra would basically wake up, get dressed for the day, go to work, come home, change, go work out, and then go hang out with this secret friend of hers. Either way, when her parents visited her, they discussed what her plans are for the future once this internship was completed and she graduated. And what she said was she would return to California, walk in her graduation ceremony, probably stay with her parents for a few weeks, maybe a month, to just like map out her next move. What she was hoping was that she would be able to move back to DC and get a job with the FBI or even attend law school there. But she did love DC and want to go back. And unfortunately, this would never happen for Chandra. So let's go back to May 7th when Bob Levy made that call to the police department handling Chandra's missing report. Well, that next day, May 8th, Bob and Susan Levy called them back, the police, with more information, such as the name of this congressman and what they knew about him so far. Like I said, they had found that number in her call records. She had been calling this number and it had been calling her repeatedly, regularly since October of 2000. So they called it and they got a recorded message letting them know that this was the office of California Congressman Gary Condit. Just a quick background on him. Gary was born in Salina, I think is the name of it, Oklahoma, on April 21st, 1948, to Velma and Adrian Condit, who was a Baptist pastor. Gary graduated from Tulsa's Nathan Hale High School in 1967 and promptly married his high school sweetheart, Carolyn Berry. Then Gary and Carolyn moved with the Condit family from Oklahoma to Ceres, California, which is like nearby Modesto, like that same year at a church over there, and they wanted to keep the family together due to Gary's father becoming a pastor. So Gary enrolled in Modesto Junior College, where he received his Associates of Arts degree in 1970 before moving on to California State University Stanislaus, sorry, achieving his BA in 1972. Following graduation, he began his political career by joining the Ceres City Council from 1972 to 1976, serving as the mayor for Ceres, California, at just 25 years old, making him the youngest mayor in the history of the city. And he served as the mayor his final 2 years on that council. So his term ended as mayor in 1976. Gary then went on to serve the Stanislaus County Board of Supervisors from 1976 to 1982 until he was elected to the California State Assembly in 1982. And in 1989, in a special election after the resignation of House Democratic Whip Tony Coelho, Gary Condit was elected to Congress and elected to a full term in 1990. Then reelected five more times without serious difficulty. Therefore, he served from September 12th of 1989 until January 3rd of 2003. And interestingly enough for me to note, he actually was at the time that this is all going down, so 2001, a senior member of the House of Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, which is the primary committee in the United States House of Representatives charged with the oversight of all U.S. intelligence community.
Oh my God.
Well, because of who he was, Gary's family lived in Modesto, California, nearby Chandra's family. However, he had a condo in D.C. that he worked at regularly the majority of the time. So when Bob and Susan learned that it was his office that was calling their daughter back and forth, instead of just like working their way through voicemails and secretaries, they just pulled out their yellow pages for Modesto phone book, found his name, and fucking called his house directly.
Oh, I was hoping they drove there.
No, Gary answers though.
Oh shit.
He happened to be there. Immediately, Bob and Susan lay out the situation. Like, this is what they're saying, but I'm paraphrasing it, obviously, and saying it in my own words, so this is not a quote at all. But they're like, no pleasantries. Look, our daughter is Chandra Levy. She is missing. We haven't heard from her since May 1st. We pulled her phone records, and y'all be chatting a fucking lot. So Naturally, we put the damn pieces together and realized that you must be her little secret friend.
Right, and you're clearly the last one to talk to her. Mm-hmm. So
our question for you is, where the fuck is our daughter? And as pretty much expected, Mr. Gary pulls the dumbass card, basically telling Bob and Susan that he has no idea where Chandra was, who she was, saying that they didn't really know each other all that well because they had only met a couple of times. Yet he then follows that statement of, I can't place her with, you know what, I was more of a DC mentor for her, that's why we chatted a lot, but you know, I don't know where she's at, good luck. And that was that. Well, as the Levys are doing this, they get a call from Linda, who is either Bob or Susan's sister, or I'm sorry, sister-in-law. I'm not sure which side of the family she's on. And she tells Bob and Susan that Chandra had confided in her about a relationship with Gary Condon. Linda explained that when Chandra visited her for Thanksgiving in November of 2000, just about a month after she moved to DC, because Linda lives in Maryland, is the first time she heard about this relationship. However, she did not know exactly who the man was, as Chandra had refused to tell her his name. She explained that just days after moving to and getting settled in DC, so this would have been like early October 2000, Chandra and her friend Jennifer, who were both from the same university of Southern California, they were walking around the Rayburn House office building to get familiar with it when they passed by the office of Gary Condon. And Chandra recognized his name as being from her area.
Right.
So they decided to stop in and introduce themselves, and they asked for a tour from someone in the office, only to thinking that someone's going to, you know, like a low grade intern is going to walk on. I'm like, yeah, no, dude, Gary Condon, 52-year-old, walks out and he's like, oh, let me give you two ladies a tour. He takes Chandra.
I have so much commentary about this man, but I'm just going to keep my.
No, you can say it all.
Oh, he's a fucking creep.
And it gets worse.
Oh, God.
It gets fucking worse. Okay. So he took Chandra and Jennifer to the gallery of the Capitol and showed them around, chatting about their lives, asking about their lives, what their internships were, their plans for the future. And because Jennifer didn't have a job yet, Gary offered her an internship in his office, which she happily accepted. But as for Chandra and Gary, their relationship would fully form behind closed doors, following a series of phone calls after he offered to, quote, mentor her. According to the reporting by the Washington Post, Chandra was excited and so happy about this relationship when she told Linda about him, giving details such as he was in Washington for the most part, but he would go home out of state occasionally where he had a wife and two kids. He was in government and showered her with very lovely, expensive gifts and lots of attention. However, he was extremely strict about their relationship remaining 100% a secret with many rules set into place, including, and fucking hold on, anytime she was with him, she was not allowed to bring any form of identification with her. Just in case they were to get pulled over, she were to drop it, their names could not be associated together ever.
Wow.
Or if she was in his apartment to visit him on the elevator, if someone got in the elevator with her, she would have to pick a different floor number and get off and only get back on when nobody else is on the elevator and nobody else can see that she is getting off at his floor. They would spend the night together. They would have dinner dates in where he would cook for her in his condo or order takeout food for her. And sometimes they would go out to the suburbs for Thai food, but only at night, like really late and in a low-key side of town where he would not be recognized.
And probably a small-ass restaurant.
Yep. In January of 2001, Chandra spoke on the phone with Linda about her and Gary's relationship and how it was progressing. He had given her a gold bracelet and chocolates for Christmas or Valentine's Day. The reports differ on this. And possibly paid for her to fly home to Modesto a few times, but I couldn't confirm that on all sources. But she was head over heels for Gary at this point, and she really thought that he felt the same, like he was telling her the same things. Also, during this conversation with Linda, Chandra mentioned that they even were discussing the possibility of her being able to move in his condo with him, but still needing to work out some kinks. And obviously Linda was like, babes, he's married.
The kink is the wife.
His wife is going to have to come visit. Like, but according to a conversation that they had in early April of 2001, maybe not for long, because Chandra explained that she and Gary had a plan and that he would continue his secret affair in DC for 5 more years under the radar. And during that time, he would leave his wife when the time was right for his political campaigns. And at the end of April, just days before she went missing, he was his wife came to visit and he was supposed to, or telling Chandra that he was going to start pulling away from her in during this visit. And also I want to note, because I don't think I put this on the next timeline,
terrible for the wife.
I'm sick on all sides. It's so bad.
Fucked up.
But Chandra, let me go back to where was that at? Okay. The in the Christmas conversation, or I'm sorry, in the January 2001 conversation that Chandra had with Linda, Chandra said, like, you know, we're gonna move in together, da 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 da. He said I can move in with him. Well, we later find out, which I didn't type this in my notes because when we get to this point in the story, it's not going to be mean anything to us. But either way, around the same time that this phone call took place in January of 2001, Chandra actually called her landlord and was like, hey, I think I'm going to end my lease early because I'm going to move in with a friend. And then she called back like the next day and was like, hey, actually, the plans fell through. I'm going to keep my lease until May.
Damn.
Yeah. This is bad. Manipulative.
Yeah.
Bad.
Taking advantage. It's very bad.
It's very, very, very bad. So they had a plan. He was going to start at the end of April when his wife came to visit, starting to lose him. But it had to be right for his political campaigns. That's why it was his 5-year plan. So they were going to let some time pass, and then he and Chandra would get married. They would have a child together when she was in her early 30s. But it was also during this time that Chandra accidentally, for the first time, let Gary's name slip to Linda when she was, like, quoting the way that his secretary answers a phone and she has to like get him to get on the phone with her if the secretary answers. And this was one of the last conversations that Linda and Chandra would have about Gary before Chandra went missing.
Do you mean when Chandra would call his office, she would have to go
to the secretary
and to get to him.
There was like a code word that she said. Yeah. Fucked.
Wow.
Yeah. On April 29th, just 2 days before Chandra went missing, Chandra left a message on Linda's answering machine, during which, according to an article from the Washington Post, Chandra said, quote, hi, Linda, this is Chandra. My internship is over. I'm planning on packing up my bags in the next week or 10 days and heading home for a while. Don't know what I'm going to do this summer, and I have some really big news or something important to tell you. Call me back. But before Linda could call Chandra back, is when she disappeared. So I tell you that entire blurb because this is exactly what Bob and Susan Levy learned on May 7th after calling Gary and then calling police. So like I said, on May 8th, once they had all this information and had Linda's story and they knew that Gary was the person, they called the DC police again, this time with Linda, and gave formal statements of everything I just told you.
Wow.
Obviously.
What was the big news?
We don't know. No one knows. People assume and theorize that it potentially was that she was pregnant, or they theorize that that maybe he and his wife, like, he lied to her and started the process of leaving his wife. Who knows? Keep that, because remember that voicemail comes on April 29th.
Okay.
And this is when she's talking about we have a 5-year plan. That's going to come back. So obviously, when police get all this information on May 8th, this was big for several mm-hmm. reasons. And if anything, it finally gave police a serious cause for concern about Chandra's whereabouts, lighting a fire under their asses immediately. So they began looking into Gary Condon, showing up at his apartment, which was just minutes away from Chandra's, to ask him some questions. Well, just like he did with Bob and Susan Levy, Gary gives the police a fucking runaround. Quote, yeah, this is me quoting, but like paraphrasing basically. Yeah, I met her in October. I was her mentor. She would come to me for career advice. But, you know, we weren't intimate. We were not having an affair. I have no idea where she is. I was just her mentor. Making this a he said, she said situation.
Right.
But police knew better than to not believe where there's smoke, there's fire. So by May 10th, investigators had obtained a warrant to formally search Chandra's DuPont Circle apartment, during which they located Chandra's ID, her phone, her purse, her credit cards, her computer, and basically a packed up apartment and suitcase, like partially packed up apartment and suitcases just lying around. But the only things that were missing were her keys and a gold ring with her initials on it that she wore religiously, like it was one of those pieces she never took off, as it was a graduation gift from her parents. And obviously, like, a fit. She was wearing clothes. But her ID's there, her phone's there, her wallet's there.
Which is also everything that he says she can't bring.
Exactly, Morgan. Exactly. At the apartment, investigators found that Chandra's answering machine was full with messages that were left by her family and friends, and two from good old Gary Condon.
Uh-oh.
Though I'm not sure on the dates and the exact times that these messages were left, but we can assume, obviously, they were left between May 1st and May 10th because that's the time that she's been missing. When we get to the timeline of his alibi, this, I think we can pinpoint the day a little bit better. But in one of them, he says, it's 11:45. I'm sorry, I've been tied up for the last few days, but you already know that. His wife is in town, by the way, spoiler. Give me a rundown on kind of what your schedule is. Things are looking pretty good for me today anyway. Bye. And then in a second one, he says, it's 6:30. Haven't heard from you. Maybe you're out of the country or something. Anyway, give me a call back if you get this message. If you get this message. Bye. Out of the country.
Out of the country.
If. When?
Yeah, what?
Sus. Weird as fuck.
That is weird.
Weird. The wording on
that. Who just to me is like, oh, did you go out of the country?
You go out of the country? She's 24.
And
she's here on an internship.
Right.
She graduates in a week.
And she's planning to go home.
Right. And you know this. Like, what are we talking about? I thought you were buying her plane tickets. Right. You know what the plan was. Are you out of the country?
You've been
knowing. Are you out of the country? Fuck off.
If you get back.
What? Why wouldn't she be back? I mean, when? Weird. Either way, as I said, they also found Chandra's personal laptop and they wanted to get a look at her last few searches. Well, what her last few searches were and her emails from the time that she went missing. And instead of waiting on the professionals, like they should have, to analyze this, a police sergeant from the Metropolitan Police Department decided that he was going to give it the good old try hard and examine it himself. This is 2001 and this man is probably, what, 50, 60 for him to be a police sergeant?
Yeah.
You don't even know what a computer is.
You don't know how to find search history.
It's dial up. Like, you literally don't know what you're fucking doing. You literally don't know what you're
fucking doing. I couldn't even find search history on a dial up.
Exactly.
Computer.
According to the police department, at first, this was the first thing that went out. The computer just mysteriously crashed at that very moment and they lost all the data.
Oh my God.
But the truth comes out later, duh, where we learn that because bro had no fucking business touching that laptop, he, quote, inadvertently, end quote, corrupted the internet search data, forcing them to send it off to the big dogs, aka like computer specialist experts at fucking Macintosh, and had them reconstruct the data and restore the computer to where it was prior to him logging on, which took over a month, by the way. Just for me to know, I think that is really sus.
Suspicious. I was going to say that.
Potentially done on purpose.
Like maybe he did know the right things to
do. Yep. And like what police sergeant back then in 2001 would be like, oh, yeah, I know how to work a laptop.
Right.
Yeah. I don't think so.
It's like someone's like, here's 20 grand. Go in there, press these two buttons.
Yeah. That obviously that's just like a theory, a very much conspiracy theory. Mm-hmm. But like it just weird doesn't coincidence right, of anything. It does not sit right. Well, we will come back to this in a second, though, because I have a second fuck up by police that I have to tell you about.
Of course.
And that is...
There's never just one.
There's never just one.
If they're fucking up the whole... They either do fantastic
or they
fuck up everything.
It's like a fucking bull in a china shop.
Yep.
So the next thing that they fucked up was the CCTV footage from Chandra's DuPont Circle apartment. Because you see, this is 2001, which means the security cameras were CCTV, which means that they would just loop over each other after a certain amount of time and you can never get that footage back. And it just so happened that for Chandra's apartment, it happened every 7 days. Well, because they had waited so long to investigate instead of just going full steam ahead and pulling security footage whenever they went to do that welfare check on May 6th, there was absolutely no footage of Chandra leaving her apartment that day. So we have no idea what she was wearing, if she was alone, what mood she was in, what her body language looked like, nothing.
Wow.
But in addition to those voicemails from Gary and the computer that mysteriously crashed but eventually is revived, investigators found one more thing in Chandra's apartment. It was a pair of underwear that contained a stain of dried semen. Now, you have to remember, up until this point, Gary Condit has been denying any sort of relationship with Chandra outside of being her mentor to police and her family. So investigators took this semen. This is in the very early stages of DNA.
Why are you jizzing on underwear?
Fucking embarrassing.
He's 50. This is cum rag.
Get out of here. So investigators needed to test the semen to see if it was Gary's in order to honestly force him to speak about their affair to them, at least. So they send it off to be DNA tested against his, because I guess like congressman, we have your DNA, and boom,
match
scary semen in her apartment, in her underwear or his underwear or something, I don't know. For the first time, confirming for police that Chandra and Gary were in fact 100% having an affair. And we know how these things go. Almost overnight, all of this gets leaked to the media. Chandra's case and the affair are plastered over every single media outlet, front pages, headline, bar banner of Good Morning America, whatever the hell was going on back then, dramatically altering the case, the case's speed, and the pressure that police were facing. Mm-hmm. Already making fuck ups before there was pressure. But we will come back to this because we need to tie up some loose ends. So, after searching Chandra's apartment, her phone records, computer data, and interviewing basically everyone in her life, including Mr. Gary, investigators were able to create a timeline of Chandra's last movements, which I'm going to walk us through now, and I'm also going to do it alongside Gary Condon's. And I got this from an ABC News article that had like a timeline written out. So thank you, ABC News, for that.
Thank you, ABC.
That was iconic as fuck. Amazing. Appreciate it. So let's get into it. Monday, April 23rd, 2001. This was Chandra's last day of her internship, which ended sooner than expected due to her graduation requirements being completed earlier than expected. On Saturday, April 28th, 2001, Chandra called her landlord, leaving two messages on his answering machine saying that her job had ended abruptly and that she wanted to set a move-out date. And then she emailed her landlord after these two calls, leaving the two messages requesting to move out soon, quote, possibly May 5th or 6th, because this is so quote, because I have no real reason to stay around here, end quote. And again, this is on April 28th. We also know that on this same day, Gary Condon's wife arrived in Washington, D.C. According to his office schedule, Gary and a member of his staff, so I'm thinking like a valet, picked her up from the airport at 7:30 p.m. and then they went to a dinner at a local like restaurant in D.C. Sunday, April 29th, 2001. That's where we're at now. This is when she leaves that message for her Aunt Linda and is like, hey, I have some big news to tell you.
Okay.
So Sunday, April 29th, 2001, also his wife arrives on the 28th. This is the conversation visit that he's supposed to allegedly be right, like starting the process of leaving her for their 5-year plan. So, okay, April 29th, 2001, Aunt Linda gets that voicemail from Chandra needing to tell her something important, during which Chandra seemed to be in good spirit, no indication that it was bad news or anything like that. And then Chandra finally was able to talk to her landlord that same day about that May 5th or 6th move out date. As for what Gary was up to, he was at brunch and then went shopping with his wife that morning before going into his office together for a little while. And then that evening, they went to a local Italian grocery store together before returning to Gary's apartment to cook dinner together. And allegedly, according to what Gary told police, this was the date that he claimed was his last phone call with Chandra, like where they chatted on the phone, which I don't know how that's fucking possible because it's a Sunday. You're not working.
Right.
You're with your wife all day. She's there. So how the fuck would you talk to her? Unless maybe that's why he stopped by his office, was to call her and like send his wife to go talk to someone. I don't know. I couldn't find any more detail on that. Then on Monday, April 30th, 2001, Chandra goes to her gym, which was the Washington Sports Club, and she cancels her membership after working out, leaving the gym after 7 p.m. As for Gary, he had his staff pick him up in the morning, take him to his office where he worked until about 11:30 a.m. Then he went to the White House for a lunch. And then at 1:30 p.m., he went back to his office and then returned to his apartment to have dinner with his wife at 5:30 p.m. Tuesday, May 1st, 2001. Chandra leaves her parents an email sometime around like just before noon or right after noon, where she listed off some potential flights that she could take home through Southwest to get her home 5th or 6th. She then stayed on the internet, according to her computer data. She then stayed on the internet going through many sites, which I'm going to go through here in a second, until 1 p.m. And that is the last known trace of what Chandra was doing that day. As for Gary, his staff picked him up for work that morning. He met with the vice president, Dick Cheney, at the time at 12:30 p.m., returned to his office at 3:30 p.m., went to a doctor's appointment at 5 p.m., and then casted votes before returning to his apartment to have dinner with his wife, who was still there. This one's weird to me because the day that Chandra goes missing, you all of a sudden have 500 trillion appointments and one of them is with the fucking vice president.
Yeah.
Wow.
Whenever you and just a doctor's said on the voicemail, I mean, I'm pretty clear. Oh, no, wait, that was after.
We have no idea. That was sometime between May 1st, but his wife, he went home and had dinner with his wife.
Right. And your wife's there and you're making all these appointments.
Right. Okay, so now let's go to what they found on the computer. According to FBI Special Agent Jane Dombrowski's findings on Chandra's laptop, shortly before midnight on April 30th, Chandra sent an email to her mom. Then just after midnight, now in the early morning hours of May 1st, she began a search related to Gary Condon's name. Before researching a cross-country Amtrak trip that would depart from D.C. on May 5th and arrive in Stockton, California on May 8th, and she was looking at booking one of the luxury sleeper cars. But interestingly enough, for all of her Amtrak searches, she used the name C. Love, like Courtney Love, which was Kurt Cobain's.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh.
Weird.
That is weird.
Yeah. And it seemed that, here's my theory on that. I wonder if Gary was like, we can just spend the last little rendezvous on this train. I need to go home anyway. We can get a private luxury sleeper car, see, you know, what the prices are. I'll book it. But, you know, don't put your name on it. Because why else would she not use her name?
Right.
Yeah. And it seems that she continued searching on the internet, looking up Gary, looking up Amtrak every now and again until around 2 a.m. in the morning. And again, this is early morning hours of May 1st. Then on the afternoon of May 1st, she sent that Southwest flight to her parents. And then she spent another hour and a half searching on the web for various things. Now, these searches included Southwest Airlines, Baskin Robbins, girl after my own heart.
I know, me too.
Medium chocolate milkshake, please. Thank you. A weather report from the Washington Post, and then the Condon family. She individually searched for Gary, Carolyn, his wife, and then their son, Chad. But what stood out the most to investigators were her final two searches. The first one being at 11:33 p.m. for information about Rock Creek Park in the Washington Post Entertainment Guide, and this is a park in D.C., from which she clicked on a, like, pop-up link from the map at 11:34 and did some sort of, like, zoom in or something that they found in the data that said that she was looking specifically at the Pierce Klingle Mansion, which is, like, the park headquarters. It's a historic building. And her final search was made at 12:59 p.m. for a region in France that it's, like, Alsace, Lorraine.
Are you going out of the country? Are you out of
are
the
you
country?
Going out of the country? Whoa. And she just like searched it for a few seconds and got off. Like looked it up. Sus. Now, like I said, it took a really long time for investigators to get this far in the case because they were unable to get that laptop analysis, Gary to talk, DNA testing back until like mid-June. So, and also this is due to their own fucking mistakes. Okay, this is no one's fault but themselves. Mm-hmm. They fucked up. So during that time, there were some searches for Chandra and lots of media coverage. However, very little developments in the actual investigation as to her whereabouts, mainly because detectives needed the information that I just told you to be able to move forward and figure out where she would have been going. Well, by the time that they have all this information from the computer and all that, and it's not looking good for Mr. Gary, they finally get him to agree to do an interview in late June, early July. And it was during this interview with Gary Condon that investigators got his timeline and alibi for the days leading up to Chandra's disappearance and after. And allegedly, the first and only, mark my words, only time that he has ever admitted on the record to having an affair with her. Yes, you heard that right. He has never, ever openly admitted to having a relationship with Chandra Levy, only calling her his mentor, mentee. Also, and it's like, you look up like current interviews where she gets brought up and he's like, I maybe saw her once.
Are you kidding me?
Dude, I'm not fucking kidding. This guy's crazy. You've been caught,
but he does openly admit it one time.
He tells it to the FBI, but it's like in sealed documents because it was like a confidential meeting from a federal official, basically.
Wow.
So it's not like public information, but the FBI was like, he confirmed it in that meeting. Dumbass.
So fucking fucked up.
So bad. So yeah, they didn't really get anything out of that interview with him.
Is this man still alive?
Yeah, but just don't worry because we're gonna come back for this little fucking bitch.
Good.
And we're gonna I just needed a few more minutes to really finish firing you up because this is not even like
yeah I cannot yeah. stand him.
So they didn't really get anything out of that interview with Gary other than the confirmation that he and Chandra were having an affair and his alibi. However, they must have gotten something from him, because the next thing that they go do is interview a flight attendant named Anne, and her full name's out there, but I'm just out of respect not gonna put her full name out there, which was another woman that Gary was having an affair with at the same time that he was having the affair with Chandra. And when police or FBI gets her to come in and sit down and have a meeting, the first thing she says was, quote, "Gary told me that I didn't need to talk to the FBI about his personal life and even tried to get me to sign an affidavit." Because right when Chandra went missing, he ended the affair with Anne and cut all ties with her, yet still trying to control her, only reaching out, trying to anticipate the fact that police would probably come looking for her due to this affair with Chandra, who's now a missing person. So before police were even talking to him fully, like back in May, when Chandra first went missing, he ends everything with Anne and it's like, "You need to sign this affidavit." What are you hiding?
I would have been like, "Excuse me?
What are you fucking hiding?" Yeah.
Yeah. If this doesn't end with him being guilty, like I don't know how this is, I don't know how it couldn't.
Yeah. Okay. So obviously police reach out to Gary again, possibly on July 7th. To get another interview because they wanted to chit chat about what he's doing with Anne.
Right.
What's that about? And this time they upfront requested, like, "We want to do a polygraph test." And Gary refuses because he is so upset with the FBI for leaking stuff to the media. And they're like, "Bro, we're not leaking stuff, dude."
Right.
"We're leaking, you know, if there's a leak, who gives a fuck? You're down bad." Well, this was a big mistake on Mr. Gary's part because you know what the FBI did? Bitch, they got a search warrant for his DC apartment on July 10th, 2001 Good. As a part of their new investigation into him for possibly charging him with obstruction of justice.
Oh, shit.
The FBI spent hours in Gary Condon's apartment. I think they did this at the end of the day.
If you weren't involved and it was just an affair, then let them do their investigation and move the fuck on.
Right.
The way you're acting, you look like a fool.
You look like a fool. You look like a buffoon.
Like, I can't.
If you weren't guilty, you look it, dude.
Right.
You stink. You smell of it.
Yeah.
So
reeking in guilt.
The FBI gets that search warrant on July 10th, and they did it in the evening. And the FBI spent hours in his apartment removing furniture, books, pieces of the carpet, cutting out pieces of his carpet, chunks from the wall. I mean, basically searching through every single thing. And they sent it all off for processing. Unfortunately, though, comes back clean. They cannot find anything that could connect Gary to the disappearance of Chandra. That is until a few days later, when this guy comes forward to FBI and says he's got an interesting story. According to this man, the night of July 10th, just hours before the search warrant was carried out on Gary Condon's apartment, which was all over the news, might I add, this man says that he was out by the dumpster of the apartment complex where both he and Gary live, and he sees Gary Condon doing something weird. According to this guy, seems like he's halfway in the dumpster, pushing shit around, and then placing something at the very bottom and quickly, frantically trying to cover it up and walk away real cool.
Not the congressman in the dumpster.
Well, of course, because we know just how this investigation has been going so far, the investigator's like, "Oh shit, bro. We forgot about the trash. We gotta go get the trash."
Yeah, wait, isn't that like the number one thing they do? But also, who leaked that they got a warrant to him?
Well, exactly, because no one knew about it until it was carried out.
Right.
And I pulled up, I went to the archives, of course I did. I went to the archives so I could figure out what the first reports were on this search. And there were statements that were being put out by like the Washington Post where they were like, "This just in, Gary Condon's apartment being searched. He's inside, we believe, with investigators possibly being interrogated. You know, we're going to find more information." And it's like, they're like live reporting on this.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was a surprise, allegedly, but clearly not, because how'd you know, Gary?
Clearly not, yeah.
How'd you get back there, Gary?
And also, Gary, you had months. What? Why would you hold on to that?
Right.
Whatever it was.
Whatever. So, police, dumbass, we're going to go get the trash. So they hustle back there and they get the dumpster, thank God, before it's taken away. And they were able to go through it. And they found something. It was an empty watch box, like a jewelry case. this is the for real FBI. Like, it's not just me, because I feel like I could have traced this back somehow, but it's the actual FBI. So they're like, no problem. Fucking give me that watch box, and I'm going to track down who bought this and when they bought it and who sold it and where it's been. Serial numbers and everything. And it leads them to this woman named Jolene. And boy, was Jolene just waiting for somebody to ask her about fucking Gary Condon, because she had a fucking story to tell. Basically, she used to work for him in his office in DC, and they had like years long of an affair. And at some point in their affair, she gave him that watch as a gift. And I know that the gift was given 7 years prior, so like early 90s. But as for their affair, as time went on, Gary began becoming like very overbearing and controlling about how this had to be a super secret affair, and just putting a lot of pressure on her and like manipulating her and giving like so many rules that she just found that this is in no way, shape or form worth it, right? Especially because he's already manipulative and controlling. He probably
gave her a 5-year plan too.
Right. And she was like, that's exactly what she said. She's like, I just ended it and I stopped working for him because he's controlling, manipulative and a liar. So I got out of there. Now, though this doesn't have anything to do with Chandra's case technically, police found it really odd that Gary would go to these lengths and like sneak around a dumpster just moments before, hours before his search at his apartment, and throw something so minute away to hide a former affair that has nothing to do with this, which left them just even more suspicious of Gary Condon. Yet, Morgan, never once, not one single time, did they ever list him as a suspect or a person of interest.
Of course they didn't.
Of course they didn't. And after all of this, with the insane amount of media coverage and digging, Gary Condon just shuts down. He refuses to speak with anyone on the matter or anyone at all, leaving police virtually in the same exact spot that they were before even speaking to Gary or getting, you know, they only had the fucking computer data. So that's where they picked up their investigation, with those last few searches on Chandra's computer, specifically Rock Creek Park. So this is a huge park that I think, I might be really wrong on this, I might be getting this quote confused with Joyce Chang's case, but I believe it's Chandra Levy's case where everyone's like, it's two central parks. This area is two central parks.
Okay.
That's how big it is. And it sits just north of downtown Washington, D.C., where investigators theorize that Chandra was going to run on May 1st, because that's all that they can think about. She's looking at these trails and like,
you know, she a runner?
She worked out a lot. Like I said, she canceled her membership after she worked out. Like, she might have been wanting to move her body. And I think she was like a vegetarian. She didn't really drink. She didn't really smoke. Like, she just really cared about her health. Mm-hmm. So I think that she was more athletic. But
yeah,
I don't, we'll get to that. But okay, so that's one theory, that she's going on a run. The second theory that police have is that she was potentially going to meet someone at that like headquarters for the park because of her zooming in on it and specifically looking it up. Now, starting on January 25th, 2001, 3 DC police sergeants and 28 police cadets searched along the roads throughout Rock Creek Park, going as far as 100 yards off each of the roads. But unfortunately, they did not find anything. Because they are fucking idiots, Morgan. That is why they did not find anything. Basically, they were supposed to search 100 yards off each walking trail. But, quote, we just got confused, so we all just did the roads. Why the fuck would she go to run on the roads?
Oh my God.
Through this park.
No, even, they weren't even trying. They were just looking like
their entire theory was that she was going there to fucking jog. So why would you think that she would jog on the road?
And not the trail.
And not the trail. Despite the fact that everyone knew her, that knew her, said that she would have never gone alone for a jog in normal circumstances because she was scared of being abducted. Because this happened a lot at this time, clearly.
Clearly, yeah.
In this area. Which we know this was not normal circumstances, though, so I'll give her that, because of the moving and canceling her gym membership and whatever the fuck is going on with Gary.
And I know whenever I have a lot of pent-up frustration, like just of life in general, I run.
Right.
And that could be the first time in 3 years.
Yeah, or I'll just go on a walk. Or I just got to get the fuck out of my house. Like, yeah. I just got to stop being in one place. I have to move. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to give that, but still, we don't know if she really went there to run. We don't know if she went there to go meet somebody. And if she went to go run, wouldn't she? It's like a long minute from DuPont Circle. So like, I'm thinking that
she'd have to drive.
She would have to drive, which I don't think train. She had a car. She would have to take a train. She'd have to take a cab. But she didn't bring any cards with her, nothing.
Right.
So, sounds I don't like know.
Someone picked her up.
Yeah, exactly.
But we wouldn't know because we don't have CCTV.
Right. Either way, the public would not learn about all of these fuck-ups until 2008 when the Washington Post put out this huge article spilling all of the tea. So no one knew about all of these fuck-ups back in the day. But
did they riot? I would have rioted.
They wouldn't learn about that in 2008, but what they did know was what a giant fucking buffoon Gary Condon was, because it came time that he had to start thinking about his reelection in the fall of 2001.
Please tell me he didn't get it.
So his PR team's like, you've got to get out there. You've been shut down from the public since this investigation started in May. You've got to go out and address this. And if you don't, your time in politics is going to be done, especially considering the fact that Gary Condon was the loudest, one of the loudest Democratic representatives that called out Bill Clinton in his scandal with Monica Lewinsky. Basically, there's like a quote from him, and I'm probably butchering this quote. I didn't write it down, but I think he said in a quote, how, you know, if he can't be truthful with his wife and with his family, how can we trust him to represent our party?
Oh my Gary. God, Gary, buddy, sit the fuck down.
Are you fucking serious? Pot,
why do
kettle black.
Politicians think they're so above? Like, I can't even get started.
Dude, yeah.
I'm just so wow. bad.
So what was their plan of action, you ask? They were going to do a one-on-one interview with Connie Chung of ABC News. Duh. What could go wrong? Well, the answer to that, everything went wrong.
Everything.
On ABC News Primetime Thursday program
live,
on
please.
August 23rd, 2001, Gary Condon made himself look like a total asshole who had zero morals and lacked the ability to take responsibilities for any of his own actions and be truthful. As he sat face to face with one of the best reporters and interviewing journalists in modern day history and avoided every single question that he was asked in this interview that his camp set up because it's for his reelection.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Good.
Avoided every single answer with this like almost robotic response saying, quote, I won't talk about my relations with my friend Chandra out of respect for my wife and kids and Chandra's family per their special request. End quote. Which, by the way, their special request, Bob and Susan's, was that he just help them.
Yeah.
Be truthful. Help them find their daughter. Be honest. And that's something that he never did.
He but that was their special request.
But that was their special. No, sir, it wasn't. The special request was to just stop being a big buffoon. I would have been like,
and now we're bringing out the parents of Chandra.
Exactly.
Please join us here on the stage.
For an entire 60 minutes, the entire United States of America got to watch Gary Condon dig a deeper hole for himself. But this was good for Chandra's case because, again, it thrusted her back onto the headlines. Mm-hmm. However, this little fame, this boost in traction in her case was short-lived because not even a month after this interview with Gary Condon, the entire nation would shift its focus to the terrorist attacks that took place on September 11th, 2001. Any and all resources that were focusing on Chandra's case, from the media to law enforcement, were taken off the case and used to handle the crisis that was unfolding, placing Chandra's case on hold until spring.
Wow.
When, on May 22nd, 2002, at approximately 9:30 a.m., a man was walking his dog and searching for turtles in the Rock Creek Park area when he discovered the skeletal remains of 24-year-old Chandra Levy. When detectives arrived on the scene, they found bones and personal items scattered across the forest floor on a steep incline, just 100 yards off of a walking, biking, horse trail near Broad Branch Creek in Rock Creek Park. Just a reminder.
They would have found her if they were on the fucking road.
If they would have done they would have found her 10 months ago, and she wouldn't have been skeletal at that point.
Yep.
So we'd have everything that we needed. We would know everything that we needed to know. Investigators found a sports bra, leggings, sweatshirt, and tennis shoes, white tennis shoes to be exact, which I find baffling that no one saw white tennis shoes that were mm-hmm. sitting, white, bright tennis shoes, sitting just 100 yards off of a trail ever in a year, over a year. Right. But the clothes, like the sports bra, the leggings, and the sweatshirt, they were like torn up purposefully and knotted together. Yeah. What? Indicating foul play. The remains were sent in for an autopsy that found there was enough sufficient evidence to determine that Chandra's manner of death was 100% homicide. But due to the fact that her remains were fully skeletal, a cause of death could never be determined. However, on May 28, 2002, the medical examiner, Jonathan L. Arden, announced that he found that her hyoid bone was damaged. And we've talked about the hyoid bone many times before because in cases, they kind of use this bone as a, it's not 100% fact and like foolproof, but it helps in investigations. Your hyoid bone sits in your neck. And if someone commits suicide by hanging or strangulation of any kind, their hyoid bone is rarely ever broken unless they dropped from a large
drop off.
If it is broken, because it takes a lot of force to break this bone,
blunt trauma,
it's either like someone's choking or like repetitive strong, it's a person's doing. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of like the rule of thumb, but it's not like foolproof, like I said, but it's just like what's been used forever. Mm-hmm. To help in investigations. So where was I at? The hyoid bone. So he found that her hyoid bone was damaged, indicating that she was possibly strangled, but he did not deem it conclusive enough to fully determine that strangulation was her cause of death, rather supporting the finding that the manner of death should be ruled homicide. Also because that gold ring with her initials on it was never found with the remains and still has not been found to this day, and the same for her house keys. The only two things that were missing from the apartment are still missing to this day. That same day, on May 28th, 2002, when this announcement comes out from the medical examiner, the Levy family held a memorial service for Chandra at the Modesto Center Plaza with a crowd of over 1,200 people. There, members of Chandra's family and closest friends spoke to the crowd, telling them all about Chandra and her life. A year later, on May 27, 2003, she was buried in Lakewood Memorial Park Cemetery near her home, just outside of Modesto. And to the public, this is really where Chandra's case falls off. People kind of forgot about it. But years later, in the summer of 2008, when that article that I was telling you about was released from the Washington Post that reminded the public of Chandra and for the first time told the public the full and true story that I have just given you in this entire episode, spilling all the tea about Gary from top to bottom, they talked about every single fuck up that police made that hindered the case and how it hindered the case exactly, and then left America with a new suspect that had been barely spoken of, one that I haven't even gotten to yet, and his name is Ingmar Gwandike. Now, before we get into this, though, please understand that I'm about to do my very best at condensing a lot of information that would, in real life, if I went through it all step by step, it would take 4 episodes to fill out. I'm not joking, just what comes after this. So just trust that I can explain it better at the end, and like I'm gonna be tying loose ends together, but I just have to flood you with this insane amount of information first in order to get us there. You guys with me still?
I'm here.
All right, we got it.
You need a little breather?
I do need a breather.
Take a breather.
So let's take it back to that fucking crazy interview with Gary Condon that he did back in August of 2001, just before 9/11. Well, sometime between that interview and 9/11 happening, the police and federal prosecutors were contacted by a lawyer of a DC jail informant who claimed to have information on the killer of Chandra Levy. This informant allegedly learned that the true killer of Chandra Levy was Ingmar Gwandike, and he claimed that Gary Condon paid him to kill her.
Oh, shit.
For the price of $25,000, which he accepted to feed his drug addiction. Pretty quickly, just by checking bank statements, investigators were allegedly able to rule out any connection between Gary and Ingmar.
Sure.
They were like, yeah, there was no money in or out of anybody. So like no one knows how to hide money. Right. But, okay.
Like he didn't have 25,000 stashed away for the last 50 years.
Who knows? Whatever. However, they were really interested in learning more because not only had this guy been convicted of attacking and assaulting two other women in Rock Creek Park around the same time that Chandra was killed there, all of which that he admitted to, by the way, with the other two women. And on top of that, investigators quickly learned that he had missed work on the day that Chandra went missing. And according to his landlady, she saw him that week, like within a few days of May 1st, and was worried about him because he was covered in bruises and scratches. And the cherry on top, allegedly, is that when detectives went to his jail cell to interview him in the DC jail, he had a fucking picture of Chandra by his bed and allegedly a tattoo of said picture.
Whoa.
I say allegedly because I could only find that on one source. So I don't know.
Very weird, though.
Very specific. Very weird if it is true. And yet police were only referred to him as, I'm sorry. And yet police only referred to him, Ingmar, as a person of interest and let him go because he allegedly passed a polygraph. By let him go, he just went back to jail because he had to finish a 10-year sentence for the other two attacks of the women in Rock Creek Park around the same time. So when the public learned about Ingmar Gwandike for the first time in 2008, when police had been knowing about him since 2001, the world now was involved in this story and fucking enraged. Oh, what is going on there?
Well, and also the fact that he has now attacked two, possibly three women.
Right.
In this local park, and they no one wanted to inform them.
No one made that public, right, that was happening, that this was going on. It's just really weird. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to just kind of do a quick walkthrough of the two cases that landed him that 10-year prison sentence. So it was like the summer of 2001, just after. And wait, I have another thing to say. Why would police not immediately connect these attacks in Rock Creek Park to Chandra's case, right, knowing that her last
search location,
they had already searched it, mm-hmm, before any of this happened, any of these attacks happened. They did that first road 100 yards off the road, right, dumb fucking search, waste of time. Anyways, the other cases, here they are. In the summer of 2001, a young girl is jogging in Rock Creek Park by herself, and she has her Walkman on and listening to music. She sees him in the parking lot, like when she's stretching, and she got bad vibes from him because he was like really intently looking at her. So she starts her run and he's kind of following her. She didn't want to like overthink it though, so she grabs a stick and just starts running with this stick, allegedly, according to a source. And she realizes like, oh shit, he's chasing her.
Yeah.
Once they got like out of earshot of the parking lot. Yeah. So he's chasing her. She's running for her life. She's got this stick. They get in a struggle, but he like attacks her from behind, knocks her to the ground. They get in a struggle. She had taken like self-defense classes and she had recently taken them, so she fucking was fresh on that shit. Somehow, by the grace of God, thank God, gets away with her life, and she
kicks his ass, I hope.
Bit the fuck out of him, I think is what happened. Calls police, he doesn't get caught. So about like a month later, so this would have been like late summer, early fall of 2001, just before 9/11, a young woman is on a jog in Rock Creek Park with her fiance. She has her Walkman on. Her fiance ran ahead of her because, you know, girlies need a break sometimes. Mm-hmm. And he runs ahead of her, and this man begins jumping out of the bushes, following her, chasing her. She's running for her life. He catches up with her, like tackles her from behind, drags her down this ravine. They get in a really bad fight. She was like, had a knife against her cheek, and she was like, what do you want? She had her engagement ring on. She was like trying to give him the engagement ring. He just wanted to attack her, according to this woman. She somehow is able to get away. I don't know how. And finds another person walking on the trail who I guess had a cell phone or something and was able to call 911. So police got there way faster, especially since that other attack had just happened previously. And I'm assuming because Chandra's case,
also
they were on high alert about this area. So he gets arrested because they find him hiding in the bushes, and they take him in. He gets sentenced to 10 years. He admits to it. So on March 3rd, 2009, the Superior Court of the District of Columbia issues an arrest warrant for Ingmar Gwandike. And on April 22nd, he was formally charged in D.C. with the murder of Chandra Levy and indicted by a grand jury on 6 counts. OK, here are the 6 counts. Kidnapping, first degree murder committed during a kidnapping, attempted first degree sexual abuse, first degree murder committed during a sexual offense, attempted robbery, first degree murder committed during a robbery. I understand the robbery and I understand the kidnapping because we can't say if she was lured to this location or not, but the sexual offense and assault, like,
how do we know that?
I don't know how they got there. Maybe they were just throwing as many charges as possible on him to get him like a part of this grand jury and get him indicted so they could have him on Chandra's case. But what blows my mind is like how quick all this happened, that they went from
nothing,
years of nothing, knowing about him since 2001. That article comes out in August of 2008, and then by March 3rd 2009 he is arrested. He has an arrest warrant out and he's charged in April.
Well, and he's obviously pretty like prone to admitting his crime. So did he admit this?
Never. He maintains his innocence.
Oh.
Yeah. So he pled not guilty to all of this, and his trial was set for October 4th, 2010. On November 20th, and guys, this is where I'm telling you, I'm just throwing a lot of information at you. If I did the full thing, it would take me 4 episodes. I wish I could walk you guys through these trials, but at the end, I'm just going to try to get us there. And if you want to learn more, like, there are so many sources, so many documentaries on this case that I recommend you to do, but we just don't have the time here today. I wish we did. But on November 22nd, 2010, he was found guilty of both of the remaining first degree murder charges, and all of the other ones were dropped. So I believe that he was charged with first degree murder committed during a kidnapping and first degree murder committed during a robbery. This was appealed many times. Him and his attorney appealed many times. And after several hearings about his motions for a retrial, they were all denied, and he was sentenced to 60 years in prison. But then there was a clusterfuck of new information that came in, and then the informant basically got caught lying on stand, like really bad, like not a good, is not reliable. The informant that was like, yeah, he told me that, da 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 da, was not reliable. So that comes out, and in the end, the court ruled that there was too little concrete evidence and basically only circumstantial evidence that got him this conviction for Chandra Levy's case. And because of all these fuck ups and this informant, he deserved to have a retrial, right? So basically, this is what I'm trying to say. They knew 100% that when all this shit came out, that he would be granted a retrial because of the massive combination of these fuck ups by police in the entire case, plus the insane amount of information that had been out there on the case prior to this person calling in this informant. Like, he could have learned all of that stuff from media. And then you have this allegedly admitted to all of these things, and then there's a new witness that says that they saw her running, or I didn't see her running, and then the fallout of the informant. Like, so much shit happened. So they knew that he would be acquitted of all charges and be walking free and still like not have to serve those 10 years for those other two crimes. And people believe that he did it 100%, that Ingmar Gwandike 100% murdered Chandra Levy, but they just can't prove it because it's all circumstantial. So instead, the court decides that they don't want him walking free, and so they couldn't give him a retrial. So instead, in July of 2016, they announced that they would not be proceeding with the case, and they dropped all charges against him, just to deport him back to El Salvador, where he moved back to in May of 2017. Therefore, technically leaving Chandra Levy's case unsolved to this day, and Gary Condit basically out of politics for like fucking ever, yet somehow he's still married to his wife. And Chandra's parents have said in interviews that the reason they believe that they held so tight to Gary Condit in the beginning was because it was the only person that they could point blame at, the only person that would have motive and all this stuff. But when they learned about Ingmar and like the cases and everything that went on,
my question is, did the police tell the family about him 8 years prior?
I have no idea.
7 years
prior? I couldn't confirm that. But what I do know is that the media did get wind of him back in 2001, and the police told them in a written statement that was released in that Washington Post article that they didn't need to pay too much attention to him. He wasn't anything important. So police back in 2001 were like, yeah, he has these attacks in the same park. And even when they found her remains and in the state that they were in 2002, they still never went back and picked him up. They still were like, he's not involved with this at all. And the only reason that they eventually did kind of go back into him was because A, 2008, that Washington Post article comes out and makes them look like shit, and the Publix, like, you need to look into this guy again, motherfuckers. But also because by 2008, like, I think they just wanted to hurry it up and he was going to be the easiest. But at the same time, like, I don't know what the family knows in full. I don't know if there's more information out
there. Did they ever take the lead on the, like, they took what the informant had to say, but they didn't carry it out all the way
to see if there was a connection to Gary at all, even though they said that they did. And yeah, I do know that during the trial for Ingmar, Gary Condon took the stand.
Okay.
And it was like horseshit.
I don't know this woman. Never seen her in my life.
Literally, that's basically what it was. He didn't talk about, he wouldn't admit to having an affair. You're on the stand, bro.
Yeah.
And then he basically was like,
why didn't the FBI charge him with perjury after that?
Right. Well, I think what his quote was, like, it doesn't matter what my relations were with Chandra. At the end of the day, I didn't kill her, and clearly this guy did. But, like, to me, it's just so weird that they held off on him for so many years.
And then boom.
Boom. This article comes out. Pressure's back on. Let's get an arrest warrant. Boom. Boom, boom, boom. Bada bing, bada boom. So quick. Yeah. If it was that quick, what the fuck happened? Why didn't you do that in 2002?
Like, I feel like Gary Condon got wind of him and, like, later on, and was like, oh, I can put this to bed right now.
Right. Exactly. I do want to walk you guys through the connections between Joyce Chang and Chandra. And I am going to bring it back to the reason why we discussed Chandra Levy back when we were discussing Christy Mirak. But let's first start with Joyce Chang and Chandra. Both moved from the Midwest to California at a really young age with their family. Joyce moved from Chicago to Southern California. Chandra moved from Cleveland to Modesto when they were, like, in middle school, high school, elementary school. Both in their 20s when they were attacked in DC parks. Both living in DuPont Circle and technically went missing from that area or were last seen in that area. Both were found in DC parks near or in a body of water. Chandra was found right beside a creek. And Joyce was found in the Potomac, last known whereabouts due to her wallet location near the Anacostia River. Both worked for slash had relations with California congressmen. Joyce worked for Howard Berman, who was the congressman for the 26th and 28th district in California. And Chandra had this affair with Gary Condon from the 15th and 18th district of California. Both were working for federal entities at the time of their disappearance and murders. Joyce worked for the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service. Chandra worked for the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Both had dark hair and dark eyes. Joyce was Taiwanese and Chandra was Jewish. Killed within a 2-year span of each other. Remains not discovered for an extended amount of time after death. Both cases remain unsolved. Neither of them were ever able to be given a cause of death due to the level of decomposition at the time of their discoveries.
Wow.
What the fuck?
That, I feel like, you know, moving from the Midwest to California, then to DC.
Those are just like coincidences.
Actually, maybe not even to DC. I think moving from the Midwest to California is a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
I think that California
to DC, also a coincidence.
Governors, no, I don't think so.
Yeah,
I think,
right.
California governors, California congressmen, statesmen, whatever they are.
Yeah.
I think they're all dirty motherfuckers that have affairs and they have a hitman. And, like, yeah, it was now, two just, separate people, but they got the same hitman, the same style of kill.
Just to be clear, there's no rumor or anything about Howard Berman and Joyce, but I'm with you.
Yeah.
I'm right there with you. Now, for the Christy Mirak connection, I'm just going to literally read what I wrote, a chunk from my notes that gets us there, because it needs to make sense. So I know I explained, me and Morgan kind of discussed it at the end of the last episode, but Christy Mirak was a young woman from Pennsylvania, from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where she worked, and she was found murdered brutally in her apartment. I mean, I'll never forget the her students' Christmas presents, which were books that she had gotten for them, mm-hmm. that she had wrapped by the door to take to school with her that day, because it was like Christmas Eve or something, or last day before Christmas break. They were scattered across the floor when they found her in her apartment, just covered in blood. She was murdered by a DJ that we didn't find out until like a crazy amount of years after, because of I believe it was a semen sample that they found in her apartment. Didn't have anything in the database system. So years later, CC Moore comes and she takes that semen sample and she does like genealogical building of the family to be able to find out who he is, sets her sights on someone, sends investigators to like a thing that he was working as a DJ. I think it was like a middle school dance or something. He had a Gatorade bottle. He threw it away. They grab it. Or maybe it was at the airport. There was one that was like a middle school dance. There was another guy that we've covered in the past that was at airport. Throws this Gatorade bottle away. They take it. They get his DNA off of this and they match it to that semen sample, confirming that he was her killer. But it was like almost the perfect murder. Like,
right.
So this is, I had already covered all of that. And we, at this point in the case where I'm reading, we did not know who her killer was. And so I was giving you like some background on her. And that was that Christy Mirak was born and raised in Shamokin, Pennsylvania, where she graduated from Our Lady of Lourdes Regional High School in 1985 before moving to Lancaster. I don't know how to say it. I think
they told us it was Lancaster.
Lancaster County to,
which is crazy. I've always called it Lancaster.
I'm so sorry. I just don't know. Tell me you're not from the area without telling me you're not in the area.
No one's from Lancaster.
I'll never get over those comments. She moved there to attend Millersville University. Christy was a bubbly, caring, and fun-loving, beautiful blonde, loved by friends, family, and her students. Though she had a very close relationship with her mother, Christy was very private about her social life, and very few people knew about her social or love life. Not even leaving as much as a journal behind and no cell phone calls or texts to track and sift through, because at the time investigators were missing many puzzle pieces. And in those puzzle pieces was Christy's secret boyfriend, Ken, who was the Lancaster, however we say it, labor union chief. The two had met at a bar and became romantically involved despite their 20-year age difference and the fact that he was married. Christy's best friend went to the police station to tell investigators about this love affair after they discovered her, but assured them that there was no bad blood between the two of them, because after 5 years of seeing each other and being led on by Ken, the relationship had ended recently upon discovering that Ken and his family were moving out of town for his job. So with no DNA matches and few leads, the case goes cold until 2003, when a man called the Sunday News saying that he had a quote story idea for them. The man refused to give his name and was speaking very quickly and quietly. He goes on to tell the reporter that he had been out drinking with some friends the night before when Chandra Levy was brought up in their conversation. And so he goes on to suggest to the reporter that they should do a story on, quote, women like her who were promiscuous and lived double lives that no one knew about, before commenting on the fact that the 10-year anniversary of Christy Mirak's murder was only 7 months away, and maybe then her secret life would come out like Chandra's. Oh. Immediately, the reporter contacted the FBI. Though it was too late to trace the call, the FBI believed that it was likely her killer on the other end of that phone. And the 10-year anniversary of Christy's death passed along with the 15th and then the 20th. But in 2017, investigators were contacted by Cece Moore because she wanted to take on Christy Mirak's case.
Wow.
So that's what the connection is between those three.
And
we have Lacey Peterson with the Modesto connection. And people do that conspiracy, you know, on your own time. I'm not getting into that because I think it's kind of far reaching, but I'll give it to you.
Honestly, I think all in all, dirty politics.
Dirty politics. What the fuck is going on in Modesto?
I have no idea. Weird. Where is Modesto?
It's like just, if you're looking at a map, to the right of San Francisco. And remember, that was the halfway point from where the Yosemite murders, like where they had driven, remember the two friends for the cheer competition and the mom?
Yes.
And that's where their wallet was found, at the halfway point was in Modesto, which is the only reason that the Yosemite murders was tied to Modesto at all. But they all flew into San Francisco, drove through Modesto to get to Yosemite.
I mean, I'm just sold that there is a serial network.
Me too.
Of killers.
I just,
the way that you just tied 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 cases
all together.
Like if you looked at it on the big cork board, like at a police station, like there's always something pulling them together. You can't explain it other than a fucking network.
Like, it's just, and look, I do want to be very careful with what I say, just because I know her parents, really, Chandra Levy's parents, they do believe that Ingmar Gwandike is the person that killed their daughter. I don't know how they feel about him being just deported versus, you know, having to serve a sentence. But I guess they had to, if they really truly believe that it's him, that's the best thing that they could do, was, or else he was going to walk free here in the States.
Right, and they did. They lived it, and they have parents' intuition.
If they believe it.
And so I will give them that.
I'll give them
that. Laying a case out like that, the way it was just laid out.
Yeah.
I don't want to disagree with them, but I do.
I just think that there's a little bit more than what is meeting the eye. Mm-hmm. And you know what? It could be truly just like how small, the example of just how small the world is.
Right.
To be honest. But I get why everyone, you know, I understand why people, everyone knows of this case, but we don't really talk about it that often because it's really confusing and there's a lot about it. And I do know it's controversial. So I hope everything that you guys heard me say today, you understand, is because we're a true crime and conspiracy podcast and I just did a solo without a conspiracy. So I took over the conspiracy part. This is trifecta, except for no ghosts. Not duo. It's a duo. It's a duel. So anyways,
feel like we all think the same thing.
Yeah. Something's up.
Yeah.
Something's up. Even if it was a coincidence, whatever, something's still up. Gary content has
some. I
need
to look him up. That's why I grabbed my phone. Well, oh, this is literally them.
Yeah, that's them together. And the girl that's in the picture is Jennifer, the girl that they went, that's the day that they met in October of 2000 when she walked in and asked for the tour. And that Jennifer, who's the other girl in the picture, got the job. That's the first day that they met. They took a picture. You don't have just, like, I know people were toting around their little digital cams, mm-hmm. but like, you don't just.
Eerie it is.
Yeah. It's not like today where we just have our phones. We're like, let's just take a quick selfie.
I just clicked on an article, 2016. He speaks out for the first time in 15 years after her disappearance.
Fuck
and
off,
death,
Gary.
Denying any involvement and insisting he never had an affair with a 24-year-old.
What are you talking about, Gary?
Like, you're like, is it gonna be a deathbed confession or like?
No, he'll take that shit to it. He's dirty politic. Are you kidding? Politician. He's going to his fucking grave with that.
But he looks scary.
Yeah,
not the South Park rendition of him.
He looks like a fucking rat. Let me tell you that.
Fucking little rat.
His aura is just bad.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways. Wow.
Well, that you covered that amazingly.
Thank you.
ADHD, Adderall Taylor.
She's back.
Back for today.
Back for today and only today. But she's back and she's feeling furious and had 25 pages right there.
So. That's crazy.
Yeah.
But it was good coverage. It was good.
Good. I'm good. I hope you got, if you have any
it
questions.
It was good. You did good.
It was good. Great. Good deal. I don't know if I'm going to be able to, but I wish I could put all of the sources. I have a million. But I'm going to just be completely frank with you guys. If you email me and ask for them in the next 3 weeks, I'm not going to be able to get back to you until May. So you might get lost in it. So here's my biggest sources. Are you ready? Get ready to write them down. ABC News has great timelines of the case. Washington Post, that big 2008 article, that is where it's at. That is where it's at. Just a quick Google search. I'll check it right there. Search. So those are my two main sources if you guys want to look at anything that I had to say.
Well, thank you so much for that coverage.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Morgan, for being here. Thank you, besties, for being here, too.
Thank you all for listening to Creeps and Crimes.
When we talk to you next week, she will be Miss Harris.
In 2 weeks. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Well, when they hear this, they'll hear it. The 187, you'll be Miss Harris already technically in the real time of life.
Mm-hmm.
But in this timeline that you and I are in, you are not.
Follow us on Instagram for all the fun wedding tea.
I put all the links down in the description.
At Creeps and Crimes Podcast on Instagram, at morg.m, double the G, morg.h, double the G.
You can't.
I have to.
You literally can't.
No, I can't because my last 200 episodes.
You literally can't. You're fucked.
I could do morg.mh. No, I can't change that at all.
No, you're just going to have to leave it. You're just going to have to leave it.
Mm-hmm. Maybe in a year or two.
Yeah, it's going to have to take some time. We're going to have to.
It's actually taken. Yeah. So I can't even do that.
Okay, good.
And I'm not willing to give my username up to try to take it.
Because then that person's going to get a ton of new followers from people that are listening way back.
They're gonna be like, wow, who is this girl?
Yeah.
And it's Taylor J with an A.
Taylor J with an A. Just T-A-Y-L-A-R-J. It doesn't really have like written out with a J. We've had many questions about that in the past. They're all linked down there in the description. I've started doing that recently.
Do we have our names on our logo?
No. I'm feeling cool. No, we used to back in the day. Back in the Dizay. On that one we did. On that one we did.
What one?
On the first three.
Oh, any pictures we took it off.
Yeah. We did the first three had our names, but then after that, You don't need to know that.
I'm working mounts for life, babies.
For you life, here. Babies. Right here, right now.
Right here, right now.
Don't okay.
Let Aaron hear that.
And we'll talk to you guys next week. Love you.
Love you. Bye.
Bye.